Hi, this is Jeff Kober, and we welcome you to this Disney Insights podcast. We're here at Disney's Hollywood Studios during its 35th anniversary. So much of what was the Disney MGM Studios over the years has come and gone. Only one attraction remains as it was largely designed during its opening. This park is perhaps more radically different than any other Disney park between its opening and the present. And yet, there are some really wonderful gems that were there when the park opened and are still here today. We look at those timeless pieces and what makes them such treasured keepsakes of what is Disney's Hollywood Studios today. Each of them may have some surprises you may not have known until now. So join us for Disney MGM Treasures from 35 years ago. You're also going to want to check out our website, DisneyInsights.com. Subscribe there and subscribe to your local podcast. There's going to be a number of images and videos and links that you may want to check out. Now, today, let me just start by saying it's an absolutely beautiful day, mid-80s in Orlando, and a terrific day to be at Disney's Hollywood Studios. I thought I'd walk to each of these five different treasures and talk about each in the ambience of their locations. The only challenge is when a day is really beautiful, it means you have a little bit of a breeze coming through. And that little bit of a breeze means, well, you get a lot of the wrong kinds of sounds. So I'm actually here at one of the original restaurants that was here on opening 35 years ago. And that's Backlot Express Restaurant. It is perhaps a venerable restaurant. It, like the attraction we're going to talk about a little later, was designed like all of Disney MGM Studios back then. It was designed to showcase the making of the movies and what it's like behind the scenes and so forth. And in this case, this was intended to be a prop and a scenic warehouse for prepping and making movies. Well, that was the idea of it, and it still is that way today. But we want to talk about five particular gems that I think are really worth taking a look at. They're still here today, and you can still see them. And I think that's why I wanted to focus on them today. So let's head through Disney's Hollywood Studios, and let's see these different gems as they come alive. The first of all of these is, well, Hollywood Boulevard. Hollywood Boulevard was always the entrance to the Disney Hollywood Studios, even when it opened back in 1989. The entrance to Disney's Hollywood Studios is based on the Pan Pacific Auditorium. That is an actual auditorium that was built back in the early part of the 20th century. And it was one of the first things that architect Welton Becket and his partner at that time designed. Now, Becket became really good friends with Walt Disney over the years. In fact, at one point, the two couples, he and his wife and Walt and Lillian, took a cruise to Cuba. Becket was first approached by Walt for help in actually designing Disneyland. But as Becket studied the project and looked at it, his response was, no one can design Disneyland for you. You have to do it yourself. So Walt Disney found individuals who were expert in creating backlot sets and movie scenery and so forth, and taking some of his animators as well, created a group of people that would be known as Walt Disney Imagineers. But he still came back to Becket from time to time to seek out architectural help. One of those places was the New York World's Fair, where actually buildings for General Electric and Ford were done by Welton Becket. Later on, he was to actually design Disney's Contemporary and Polynesian Resorts as Walt Disney World opened in 1971. Now, that whole unique shade of blue and that whole look and feel, that Art Deco style with the flat red flags emanating from the top of it, that was the entrance to the Pan Pacific Auditorium. Interestingly enough, it went through years of decay and actually burned completely down to the ground just a few weeks after Disney's Hollywood, or Disney MGM Studios at the time, opened back in 1989. But it's got a lot of history behind it, and it's the first treasure you see as you come into Disney MGM Studios. By the way, it sounds to me like they're doing some rehearsal behind me over at Indiana Jones. So you may hear an explosion or two as we go through. And of course, a couple of moving chairs as guests are dining here at Backlot Express. As you step into the park, you see Mickey Mouse on top of what's referred to as Crossroads of the World. Now, it is believed that Crossroads of the World, which is an actual place, it's about the size of actually that plaza which you step into when you come into Disney's Hollywood Studios. That was actually believed to be the first strip mall. There was a series of buildings that looked more like cottages, but they had shops behind it, and they later became offices. When they thought this to be a really great centerpiece, a sort of town square piece, and to it, they made it unique by having Mickey Mouse designed, and actually originally it was painted in silver, and then when they kind of hoisted it up there, you can't see it well enough, so they actually redid it and painted him in his actual colors, so it would stand out on top of the building. A lot of people don't know that Mickey's highest ear, he kind of tilts his head, and the highest ear he has on that on top of that pedestal is actually made out of copper. It is intended to be the key lightning rod at that end of the park. Lightning rods are so necessary in this community because Orlando is like one of the lightning capitals of the world. But what I love about it is it's just a great reminder that it all started with a mouse. And I just love that they took an architectural symbol like Crossroads of the World and they meshed Mickey Mouse into it. Now, on one side of where Crossroads of the World is Sid Kuhanga's. And this is kind of a weird-looking building because it doesn't look like a city building. It's actually a bungalow, and it's not based on a specific building, but on the style of bungalows that were kind of started, a kind of craftsman style that was started in Pasadena during those early years when Walt was coming into Hollywood. Sid Kuhanga is actually a fictional character, but he has a huge backstory about how he arrived from like Chicago or Ohio with his wife, and they founded this little place, and then they started selling rarities from the studios and everything. And the backstory, actually, what made it so seemingly real was that the backstory was brought to life by one of the citizens of Hollywood known as Danny Dillon. He was part of that whole Streetmosphere set. He actually passed away back in 2005. But McNair Wilson, who actually created all of the improv, and also the improv that actually began back at Epcot and World Showcase. There used to be a set of improv players that would alternate between Italy and the UK. He built out the Citizens of Hollywood. And when he built out the character of Sid Kuhanga, he specifically had Danny in mind. Now, if you are familiar with Pam Brody, going back to the UK Pavilion at Epcot, Pam Brody has played kind of as a one-woman pearly band, so to speak, on the piano at Rose and Crown for many, many years. She recently retired, although she's doing some things for here and there. But actually, Danny's wife was Pam Brody. So entertainment, people go way back together many years here at Disney. So that's Sid Kahinga's. It's gone through a lot of different iterations of what it used to be, more of a store, and now it's more of a photo genie photo pass place and that type of thing. But it continually evolves in terms of offering services and so forth. As we head down Hollywood Boulevard, one of my favorite things is Pluto. Pluto's up on is a sign on Hollywood Boulevard, and his tail moves back and forth at night as part of the the decor and part of the neon lights that you see on Hollywood Boulevard, which is just one of my favorite things, is how Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard and other parts of Disney's Hollywood Studios just lights up at night in neon. Kevin Starr of the Los Angeles Times said one time, quote, "If Paris is the city of lights, L.A. is the city of neon," end of quote. In fact, there's actually a museum of neon art in Los Angeles that pays homage to the crazy neon that has been in the park. But it's just part of the whole treasure of what you get when you visit the studios. So I just love that a whole lot. There are lots of stores along Hollywood Boulevard. But one store that is adjoining Celebrity Five and Dime is known as Edith and Adrian's Head to Toe. Now, actually, a lot of people don't even know that Edith and Adrian are actually two very real people. It's Edith Head and Adrian Greenberg, and they just were the people you went to for costuming the stars. They were the best designers in Hollywood. If you ever went to Disney California Adventure, there was a film called Golden Dreams early on. It's where the Little Mermaid attraction is now. But back in the day, there was a film that talked about the history of California. And one of these scenes is Louis B. Mayer being interviewed. And the scene goes a little bit like that, like this. Quote, "That's our motto at MGM. Make it good, make it big, and give it class." Then, seeing Adrian Greenberg, one of the people this store is named after, Mayer states, "Oh, here's Adrian, who is designing the costumes for the Oz picture. Hello. So what do we have here? This is Dorothy's dress for the Oz picture, and of course, her silver slippers." Mayer pauses and then replies, "Silver is nice, but I just thought everything over the rainbow was in Technicolor." Well, actually, Adrian didn't just do Wizard of Oz. He designed costumes for hundreds of films, was well known for his work with Greta Garbo. Edith Head is the same thing. She actually was nominated for 35 Academy Awards, having done films for some 750 films. Ten Commandments, The Sting, Sunset Boulevard, White Christmas. This is the legacy of Edith Head. In fact, a couple of things that's really cool is she actually was one of the original board members for CalArts when it was established in the last part of Walt's life. And by the way, if you don't know who Edith Head is, just take a look at Edna E. Mode, because that little fashion queen in The Incredibles is really based off of Edith Mode and her classic hairstyle and glasses. So at any rate, that is just part of one of the many stores along there. In fact, if you look up, you'll see that there's a sign saying Chapman Park Market. Now, this actually is down in the store marquee up front, but it's representative by the store itself. The store actually, the architecture of the store actually takes its cue from the Chapman Park Market in Los Angeles. And in the early days of the automobile, there were really few places to park other than along the street. Chapman Park Market was the first West Coast market specifically designed for customers arriving by automobile, with an entrance on the side to an open interior courtyard parking lot. It's why you see the sign of the building that points to the parking in the rear. It is just one of the, again, this is the kind of attention to detail that is just poured out all over the park when you go down a little further and you come to Mulholland Fountain. It's that little fountain on the right-hand side, just past the Starbucks. And that Mulholland Fountain, we actually did a podcast, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes on DisneyInsights.com. But there's a whole backstory to Mulholland and his contribution to bringing water into Southern California. And he is also featured in that same film, Golden Dreams, that used to play at Disney California Adventure. There's a whole story behind there. By the way, there's also a Mulholland-style fountain in front of the Carthay Circle Theater when you go to Disney California Adventure. So there's just a whole lot of stuff when you go down Hollywood Boulevard. Well, that's just our first example of amazing treasures that you can find at Disney's Hollywood Studios. Let's talk about our second one, which is California Crazy Architecture. Now, actually, there are many examples of this through the studio, and they still remain. When you're on Hollywood Boulevard, you'll pass by on the right side a camera in the window, a large style camera. It used to be the Kodak store, and every store in the parks, on the right, as you entered every park, there would always be a camera store. This was designed for that purpose, but it was based on, again, this California crazy architecture. Another example is the boat at the end of Hollywood Boulevard. Everybody's seen the boat that's sitting out there in Echo Lake. But very few people have any idea what it's all about. Now, that boat is currently called Dockside Diner. But originally, for many years, that boat was referred to as Min and Bill's Dockside Diner. And Min and Bill was actually a 1930 movie that starred two people, Marie Dressler and Wallace Beery. These two individuals were incredibly famous in the very, very early days. And we're talking about the early 1930s. But what made them famous is that their shtick, so to speak, was not that they were beautiful and glamorous like Clark Gable or, again, Greta Garbo. Instead, they were always considered the frumpy kind of individuals who just kind of, well, they were, maybe the best way to describe them is they were the Roseanne Barr of an earlier decade. And but she was enormous. Both of them were enormously popular and had a very big career, realizing that she was much less attractive than the other top females of her era, such as Vivien Leigh, Jean Harlow, and Carole Lombard. Dressler resorted to what she did best, comedy. She said, "I contend that every woman has the right to feel beautiful, no matter how scrambled her features or how indifferent her features." She also noted, quote, "To know that one has never really tried, that's the only death." At any rate, she actually went on to pen an autobiography called The Life Story of the Ugly Duckling. Gertie the Dinosaur, before I go to Gertie the Dinosaur, I should also pay homage to something that was not here on opening day, but was a chief icon of the park, and that was the big Mickey Sorcerer's hat. That also played off of the California crazy movement. But going back to the opening days of Disney MGM Studio, Gertie the Dinosaur, again on Echo Lake, was actually based on a vaudevillian named Winsor McKay, and he would actually have the stage act in which he had some animation created of this dinosaur named Gertie. And what he would do is the movie would play, and then he would command the dinosaur to do certain things. And, of course, the dinosaur was always going to do the same thing because it was just a movie playing. But it really was quite unique of its time. And with that, you had... So Gertie was just a big part. And I think it's also an homage to the early days of animation before Walt Disney really made a toehold in the industry. If you don't know, that is actually an ice cream stand. It's known as Ice Cream of Extinction. And they usually sell ice cream varieties. You can hear Indiana Jones being rehearsed back behind me. And also, when you're there and you see Gertie, go check out Gertie's footsteps. Big, big dinosaur footsteps that you can find that are leading to where Gertie is standing at the edge of Echo Lake. So at any rate, California crazy architecture is just one of those things that I absolutely love about Disney's Hollywood Studios. Now, adjacent to all this, again on Echo Lake, because it's right behind us, is the Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacular. This attraction was designed to be an opening day attraction. However, the show didn't technically open until about 3 months later, around August 25th or so. There were largely two reasons why it did not open on opening day. Part of that had to do with the fact that the attraction was used for a major celebrity event. George Burns performed in it, and I think the Pointer Sisters and a country act. But they, as part of the nighttime festivities and the dedicatory celebration, that theater was used to house everybody for a major event. So that happened in the first days. And the second reason why it didn't open right at time is, while the show was scripted and prepared, it actually was scripted by the screenwriters of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And while it was rehearsed and they tried to make it ready, Eisner and Katzenberg, they looked at this thing and they said, this just isn't gelling right. Technically, it did follow Indiana Jones and it did show how stunt shows are done, but it wasn't very compelling. So at the dedication, Michael and Katzenberg both turned to Jerry Reese. Now, if you remember, there was an tour based on the magic of Disney animation. And when you went on that tour, you sat in a theater and watched a show called Return to Neverland. Return to Neverland starred Robin Williams as one of the Lost Boys and also Walter Cronkite. It is truly one of the funniest and best gems ever. It is hilarious. I still repeat lines from that show. So bright, it's like being in the presence of Barbra Streisand, and that is just a fantastic show. Jerry wrote that. They turned to him and said, you need to take a look at this show and do some rewrites to make it more compelling and funny. And that's the show we got. But unlike Star Tours, which opened the following January, which was intended to be a second phase or the beginning of the second phase, this show was originally intended to be a first, and I consider it to be part of the original. This was the first theme park attraction to actually use a show control system that is computer-based and was designed with a programmable logic controller system. What that means is that they could line up all the effects, line up the sounds, line up the music and everything, and they could trigger, control, and sequence everything happening on stage at a time, and they could do that live as the actual event was unfolding. This is the only show or attraction that has remained from opening day. There are several restaurants like Backlot Express and Primetime Cafe and Brown Derby, which we'll talk about in a second, but it is the only attraction. Monsters, Sound Show, Superstar Television, The Great Movie Ride, The Backstage Tour, both the tram and walking tour, and the magic of Disney Animation. We're all opening day attractions, and none of them have remained. There are elements of it still. We'll talk about some of that in a few minutes. But this is the only show that has remained. And it's like Backstage or Backlot Express. It is the only show in the park that is a making of attraction. Remember, Disney MGM Studios operated on the premise that you were seeing the magic behind the camera. The magic of the movies would come to life. Even the Great Movie Ride was intended to demonstrate great moments in the movies and to take a sort of indoor tram tour through those great moments. But anyway, this is the only one that's has survived. And one of the things I will say is when you visit, make sure you check out the props along the queue. There's a lot of really, actually, original props that were used in some of the early Indiana Jones films. And there's just a lot of little details that they had for many years before FastPass. They had very long queues, and there's actually a whole jungle of queue right before you get to the, as you get to the entrance of the attraction. And there's stuff in it, and there's stuff off to the exit as you come around toward the Oasis Canteen. My favorite little thing is pulling the rope. If you have never pulled the rope, you gotta check that opportunity out, because it's a really cool little thing. Okay, what's next? The Brown Derby, number four. The Brown Derby, I gotta tell you, this is my favorite restaurant in all of Walt Disney World. It is truly a slice of Hollywood in the best manner possible. It is such a cool attraction. A couple of things you should know about this. The original Brown Derby was actually a derby. It was a hat. And it was part of that California crazy architecture movement. In fact, if you go to Universal Studios Florida, you can actually see that they got the rights to replicate that hat. And they have used it for a lot of years as a hat shop, although I don't know that that's what they're retailing out of there now. But this one was based on a restaurant that after the hat restaurant opened, they opened another one in 1929. And this is the one that has become famous with the Cobb salad, the grapefruit cake, and especially the caricatures of the stars. In fact, there used to be phones with long, 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 long cords so that people could take calls from their agents or from the producers during the lunch hour. And the phone was dragged throughout. And it was kind of the place to be seen in its heyday. The Cobb salad actually was made for Sid Grauman by Brown Derby owner Robert Cobb. That's how you get the name of Cobb salad, because it's named after the owner. Grauman came in late at night. He was hungry. Cobb went to the refrigerator, pulled out anything he could, minced it, and made it into a Cobb salad, and the rest is history. Sid Grauman also owned the Chinese Theater, which we're going to talk about next. But before we do so, let me mention one other thing about the Brown Derby. The Brown Derby, like I said earlier, was the place to be seen. Well, this Brown Derby here at Disney's Hollywood Studios, it was here in 2011. On the day that Star Tours The Adventure Continues. Remember, Star Tours had one scenario for years. And then George Lucas decided to create a kind of mixture of places you would go to. And that's where they brought in the C-3PO into the cockpit of the simulator, or the shuttle. And at any rate, on the day that that attraction premiered here at Disney's Hollywood Studios, George Lucas and Bob Iger had breakfast privately, all by themselves, in the middle of the Brown Derby. And it was there that George first brought up the idea of Disney purchasing Lucasfilm. He had seen how Disney had handled Pixar, seen how Disney was handling Marvel, and that negotiation and possibility began here at the Brown Derby in Disney's Hollywood Studios. Now, as I mentioned, Sid Grauman was the one that Robert Cobb had made the salad for. That brings us to what's known for many, especially old-timers like me, as the Grauman Chinese Theater. But here, it's always been called the Chinese Theater. Originally created in 1927, the Chinese Theater is perhaps the most famous of the movie palace cinemas that were made during Hollywood's golden era. It was built by Sid Grauman and also another man named Charles Toberman. That individual actually was known as the father of Hollywood. He made many, many things in that town. Toberman, by the way, also built El Capitan Theater, which sits across and diagonal from the original Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. If you've heard of the El Capitan, that's because Disney owns that theater and does many of its premieres at that beautiful theater there. The intent when Imagineers brought this in was to make the Chinese Theater essentially the Sleeping Beauty castle of the park. In fact, the distance from the turnstiles to the Chinese Theater is the same as from the train station to the castle, Sleeping Beauty Castle at Disneyland. It is that same length. And they were looking for that same kind of scale, not the larger scale that you see at Magic Kingdom when you visit it. But the intent was to perfectly replicate Grauman's original Chinese Theater as it stood at that time. But many details, actually, when Imagineers started on this project, had been lost over time. And Imagineers had to carefully and painfully recreate and bring many of these things back to life. The result is, sorry, it's a little loud, but it's Indiana Jones, you know? The result is that this version is, in many ways, here in Orlando, more perfect and more authentic than what you see at the Chinese Theater today. And frankly, when you get to the neighborhood, it's not too exciting. Across both the Chinese Theater and also at the Theater of the Stars and occasionally elsewhere can be found about 60 handprints of the stars of all sorts. Dick Van Dyke's handprints are there. Roger Rabbit's is there. Fess Parker, his handprints, I think, are at the Theater of the Stars. The Theater of the Stars usually carries more of the television as opposed to the film stars, but that is a part of the Grauman's Chinese Theater that was carried over, and many of the original handprints were done 35 years ago at the opening of Disney MGM Studios. As you go to the windows, there is an homage to both Mary Poppins and the premiere of Jungle Book. Both of them had their premieres at the original Grauman's Chinese Theater. And of course, the Chinese Theater is known as the home to the great movie ride, which, oh yeah, I could spend a whole nother podcast on why that should still be here. But now it is, of course, home to Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. The thing that's interesting and cool about that is that, and by the way, you could look at Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway as Mickey's great movie ride, if you kind of think it through. But anyway, both of them, you step into the lobby, you then go to a theater in the great movie ride. It was a big theater you kind of weaved back and forth in. Here it's two small theaters, which kind of is more indicative of how Metroplexes are today. But there you see the film of Mickey and Minnie on their picnic and taking Pluto and running into Goofy and so forth. Anyway, it's interesting how they both have a parallel. I should also mention that the Chinese Theater is the backdrop to projection shows and fireworks. Currently, that includes Disney Movie Magic and Wonderful World of Animation. I've included those videos. If you get a chance to see them, of course, there are others that have been over the years, but these continue to occur, and they're wonderful shows to see. They often run at about the same time as Fantasmic, so you might have to come two nights to see it all, but it's just part of what makes the Chinese Theater so special. If you really look at it, these five things are really incredible treasures that are still part of Disney's Hollywood Studios today, even though it's been 35 years since they first made their premiere. It is part of the magic of Hollywood here at Disney's Hollywood Studios. Well, that does it for this Disney Insights podcast. We are so thrilled to celebrate the 35th anniversary of Disney's Hollywood Studios. In many ways, it is my favorite park, although some wonderful things are happening at Epcot, so it's taking a competitive lead. But in my heart, I got so many wonderful memories from this park, and I hope to share more terrific things about this place as the year unfolds. Thanks for being part of this podcast today and for joining us. Just know that if you like these kinds of podcasts and the kinds of things we do, you want to definitely check out the Wayfinder Society. Wayfinder Society kind of takes its cue from Moana. Remember how there were wayfinders out on the sea? This is intended to discover things about Disney you never knew. And we do definitely offer podcasts and some special items, but the things that are really cool about our Patreon group, the Wayfinder Society, is that we have these interactive guides. If they were books, they would be hundreds of pages. Depending on the tier, you get certain privileges, but included in it is incredible, thorough, what will be, when it's completed, probably the most thorough study of Pirates of the Caribbean ever done. Right now, we are going to celebrate very soon the 5th anniversary of Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, and we're going to bring in a new updated interactive experience with that to kind of focus on that. Also, we have a big one on Avatar, Pandora World of Avatar, plus others. So there are different levels, and those different levels can give you all sorts of access to different things. Particularly at the higher levels, you get access to some of our, what we've often referred to as Disney at Work, those best in business ideas that we approach in many of my books and so forth. We bring out a whole series of very cool tools. We just got through talking about the casting center having its 35th anniversary at Walt Disney World. And we actually talk about the culture of hiring and selection and traditions and onboarding and recognition and communication and so forth. That is a big interactive online set of tools that are available to those who are looking for best in business practices. So much to see and do. So please go check out our link to the Wayfinder Society, because it's going to give you, it's going to be something totally different in a Patreon group. And by the way, it helps to support this podcast as well. Again, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being a part. In the words of, the Sinbad Storybook Voyage, always follow the compass of your heart. That's a wrap. Have a great day. We'll see you real soon.